We are Two Guys Gaming. Hello and welcome. As always, even though we are under the Two Generations Gaming banner, this is One Guy Reading. Whether you meant to or not, this is Noob's Book Club. I'm Sean, noob of all trades from Two Generations Gaming, and in this series I am reading and reacting to Ready Player One, the novel by Ernest Cline. This episode, I'm going away from my traditional, at least recently, three-chapter recap, and I'm going to go with four chapters because chapter 16 is not that long, and also it ends level one and brings us to level two in the book. So I will be doing 13, 14, 15, and 16 in this episode. Chapter 13. H follows Artemis and Wade onto the scoreboard. His score, in line with the 1,000-point deduction for each found key, stands at 108,000. Wade returns to school to stay out of potential trouble and out of possible suspicion that he is one of the names on the scoreboard. He needn't have bothered. With the hunt renewed, many at the school skipped the day. Irock tries to blackmail H and Wade. Neither of them takes the bait, so he posts on one of the boards that they go to school on Ludus. They hope the posts go unnoticed, but of course they do not. Two other names show up on the scoreboard, Dido and Shoto. Nobody recognizes the names, but Wade puts together that they must likely work together. Shoto and Dido are the short and long swords worn by a samurai. Together, Daisho becomes their nickname. Wade obsesses over the Jade Key riddle with all the new competition. This is the riddle, if you forgot. The captain conceals the Jade Key in a dwelling long neglected, which can only blow the whistle once the trophies are collected. He names it the Quatrain, after learning that's the name for a four-line alternate rhyme scheme poem. Who is the captain? What is the dwelling long neglected? He considers the frat house from Revenge of the Nerds, but that comes up empty. Then, trophies and a whistle. None of this work gets him any closer to an answer. He still turns it over and over to no avail. While thinking about it on a Friday afternoon, he finally looks over the backlog of messages. Many companies offer him lucrative deals to endorse their product or for an interview. He agrees under the conditions that he remain anonymous and only do business through the Oasis as his avatar. Many agreed and sent him offers in less than an hour. Without much time and no real reason to decline, he accepts. They promise payment within 2 days' time. Once he takes care of all that, he sees that IOI sent him 5,000 emails. Actually, they sent 5,000 copies of the same email. Upon opening, he auto-sends a red receipt, and the barrage stops. As expected, they want to meet him. If he declines, they intend to try the same tactic with his competitors. Hubris and quote-unquote nothing left to lose conspire against him, and he takes the meeting. He hopes to go in there, play them, and ultimately tell them to fuck the fuck off. He does some research before the meeting, figures that he has the upper hand, and clicks the button to accept the meeting. Chapter 14. As soon as he presses the accept, his avatar appears on an observation deck of a small space station or transport ship. He gives some info on the difference between chat links and chat rooms. Bottom line, more expensive, more impressive. He enters the reception area. The receptionist tells him that Mr. Sorrento, head of the division, will meet him shortly. He wonders, parenthetically, remember that Hubris I mentioned? Had naivete to that. How they knew he arrived, and then tries to start his recording software. No dice, little buddy. Sorrento arrives. They exchange fake pleasantries. Sorrento assures Wade that the chat link is part of the pitch and why they chose it over a chat room. The shuttle approaches the Sixers base planet and performs an orbit of it. Wade recognizes some of it from other images he saw, but those came from satellites and far away due to the defense system. Several Gunter gangs wanted the whole place nuked. Wade mentions that the place is a recreation of the IOI headquarters in Columbus, Ohio. That leads to a brief conversation about the inner workings of Oasis and mirrors the discussion about stock trading, how basically everyone is at a disadvantage in the face of massive auto trading software running on state-of-the-art computers so fast they essentially trade at the speed of light. Relax. No plans to spout communist propaganda here. But also, don't worry, I have a feeling that this book gives me ample opportunity to shit all over our capitalist overlords. Sorrento starts the negotiation gently, shows Wade the inner workings of the IOA, of the IOI Oology Division, casually mentions an office, and Wade gets him talking about things they use to access the Oasis. When Sorrento mentions how they work as teams, Wade protests. Sorrento scoffs at his notion of fair play. He shit talks that even with their advantage, he still, parenthetically, and others, beat them to the first gate. Sorrento concedes and sweetens the pot. All of their resources, the title of chief oologist, and a salary of $2 million with a $1 million signing bonus and $25 million when he finds the egg. Wade dances with him, eventually steering the conversation to a discussion of the ills caused by IOI on society. Sorrento deftly parries, shifting it to a quote-unquote compromise of they're really not that evil. They only want what's best for everyone. Of course, they have no choice but to charge for the Oasis, parenthetically a small fee, and increase ad revenue. Dump all of that money into user experience upgrades, parenthetically, yeah, right. And everything is awesome. Wade isn't buying it. The BS fuels him, and he starts to play hardball. $50 million bonus. Sorrento's job. The official title of El Numero Uno. Sorrento pauses and informs him IOI agrees to those terms. When? Immediately. Wade, a novice negotiator, tips his hand. Actually, he drops it on the table. Nah, he says, get fucked, Four Eyes. Sorrento laughs and immediately launches into number two. $5 million up front. All they want is a walkthrough to the first gate. Nobody need know, parenthetically, yeah, right, that it was him. No binding contract to IOI. Wade considers it. Then he comes to the realization of all risk and some monetary reward. While he considers, Sorrento puts on the pressure. Accept this. He almost pleads. Wade again refuses. Before the third offer, Sorrento says, sit down, Wade. They know his name, his birth date, and his place of residence in real life. Wade's blood runs cold as Sorrento shows him a live feed of his aunt's residence in the stacks. He sighs a bit of relief, if only for a moment, that one thing they don't know is that he isn't there. He keeps that bluff open as Sorrento continues. Don't run, Wade, he says. We wired a huge amount of explosives to the trailer. One wrong move, and boom. He thinks, hopes, that this is all a bluff. They won't kill all those people just over this, would they? What about all that, quote-unquote, we're not so bad talk? He wonders how they found all of this out. Turns out, when he signed up for school, he used his real information. They put together the messages from IROC. In some good old-fashioned school staff doesn't make shit, so let's bribe an assistant principal to figure it out. They also make a not-so-thinly-veiled threat against H. Then the final proposal. Except to be blown to bits. This breaks Wade. He can't believe they blow him up to win a video game. Sorrento finally tells him to stop being so naive. Billions of dollars at stake. Maybe capitalism should be the theme in this one. He tries one last-ditch negotiation. If he relents, nobody dies. Right? Right? No, he realizes. Either it's a bluff, or he dies either way. Truly a lose-lose. He turns down the offer, logs out, and waits for the boom. And waits, and decides they were bluffing. Except when he goes to log back in to warn his friends. Then comes the boom. I won't recap here. I'm a bit tired of 9/11 and disaster porn being the norm in action movies. Suffice to say, few make it out, alive, and the explosion gets blamed on the low-life meth cookers. Wade, in the frenzy, needs to get the fuck out of Dodge. But also needs to wait for the checks to clear. Time to find H. Chapter 15. When he logs in, he is assaulted by the ear-splitting sounds of engines above. He sees Sixer gunships scanning the surface. First he panics before remembering the no PvP status. Even so, no need to get caught napping again. He gets a message from H to call ASAP. He replies and H confirms, through inquiry, that the Sixers are on Ludus. Wade tells H about the meeting with Sorrento, the explosion, and the death toll. H offers help. Wade declines. Then Wade confirms that H also got the emails but ignored them. Wade laments he wished he did too. H sympathizes that how could Wade know that they tried to kill him? They then hatch a plan to host the five leaders on the scoreboard in the basement. Since IOI and the Sixers can figure out who they are, None of them is safe. They at least need to know the risks they all now face. Wade sends Artemis a message, then logs into the basement because he understandably doesn't want to be alone. H is already there. They hug and watch somberly as every station covers the Sixer invasion of Ludus. Artemis shows up as they shut off the coverage. Wade handles introductions. They chat a bit. Artemis compliments H on the decor of the basement. Wade notices their comfort level with each other and feels a ping of jealousy. Dido and Shoto log in to save us all from Wade's jealous rantings. Wade notices that they look similar, though Dido was taller and looked older. They appeared as Japanese in their avatars, dressed as samurai and accompanying weaponry. Dido introduces them to the group. H starts to explain the reason for the meeting by talking about the Sixers on Ludus. He says they haven't found the tomb yet. Artemis corrects him and opens a vid feed to show them the latest developments. The Sixers found the tomb and erected two force shields around it to protect anyone else from entering. Combined with the facts that they set up their teams and that the tomb automatically creates a new instance for every player, they can farm keys to their heart's content. The only saving grace is that as a no PvP zone, the Sixers can't use offensive weaponry against players, but the Gunters can mount an offensive against the shields. Shoto, aghast, laments that they have no honor. He's about to have his mind blown. Prompted by H, Wade tells the others how IOI tried to blow him up and blew up others in the process. They warn each other to keep their identities and locations as secret as possible. This leads to a conversation about IOI and how the Sixers know to search on Ludus. Dido and Shoto answer the question. They got the information from the message boards. They talk more about how the information helped each other, but also now the Sixers. This is when Wade reveals the information about the Sixers working in teams. Shoto again laments that they have no honor. H makes an innocent comment about them being outnumbered. Dido and Shoto take offense to the comment. They think it is a proposal of an alliance. They go so far as to accuse the others of possibly being spies. They log out of the meeting. H wonders when it all went wrong, and the meeting disbands with only H and Wade left. H teases Wade about his crush on Artemis. Wade denies it, and they agree to part ways to try to solve the Jade Key riddle. As they say their goodbyes, a stack of comic books falls to the floor. A glitch in the simulation, they try to assure themselves. Chapter 16. The scoreboard fills up with Sixers, numbers, and expands to include more and more of them. News quickly spreads of their location, and Ludus becomes so overrun that they make a copy of the planet for actual education. They call it, to nobody's surprise, Ludus 2, and leave out the Tomb of Horrors code. Gunters, as expected, show up to assault the shields. They finally get through with a coordinated attack from two antimatter bombs. They then prevent the shields from being reinstalled. The explosion is mentioned in the news, but gets explained away as drugs. It is then ignored. Wade collects his things, buys a bus ticket, and starts his journey to Columbus. He expects to be on the Oasis the whole trip, but actually takes time to survey the surroundings. He's never been out of the stacks before and wants to experience the real world. He needn't have bothered. Dumpy and depressing. He also secures a place to live and a new identity. The bus trip goes on without incident and he arrives in Columbus. Once there, he goes to his apartment and vows to spend every waking moment in the Oasis until the egg is found. I intend to cover a few things before moving on to my overarching topic of this episode. I promise no quote-unquote ANCAP this time, and I intend to keep that promise. However, I won't give away any more information. You'll see what I did there in a bit. First, I mentioned this at least once before, and maybe a couple of times, but I can't remember if one of the criticisms of the book involved the supporting characters. I know I addressed the concerns about the female characters and the male gaze in at least one episode. I don't know if I did it any justice, and I want it on record that the ideas are based on my own limited experience, but I'm trying always to learn and be better. I mean, we saw Artemis reduced to Wade's jealous feelings, and I see how that can be troubling. But to his credit, Klein doesn't dwell on it, and even shows some restraint in the conversation where H teases him about it. But, and I admit to being biased here, I think the supporting characters feel like fleshed out and vibrant personalities. Yes, some aspects feel two-dimensional, but I still want to give Klein the benefit of the doubt and attribute that to the fact that they are two-dimensional. They exist so far only as avatars in the Oasis. They only show their parts of their personality that they once seen. Maybe I'm completely off base here, but I will say this. I want to learn more about the people behind the avatar. I can't wait to see who H is. If Artemis is really a dude, now that Daito and Shoto get introduced, show me their story, please. Therefore, at least with me, Klein accomplishes the task of making the characters interesting enough that I want to know more about them. In one of his lengthy introductions, parenthetically, unabridged The Stand, Stephen King mentions that people will often ask him how some character or another is doing, as if he receives regular updates from them. Well, I want to text H. I'd love to get on a video chat to interview Daito and Shoto. They all seem like cool and interesting people. Second, as much as I hate to be that guy, I relate more and more to Wade with every passing chapter. He is literally me. No, I'm no hero. I refuse to take your accolades when you call parents or teachers heroes. Hell, I refuse the word in general, except under extreme situations or circumstances. As a parent, I'm expected to do things I do, and I need new accolades for it. As a teacher, it's my job, and I do those things as my job. The love and respect of my kids at home and a paycheck at work keep me going in those aspects of life. But I, as I often do, digress. Wade boards a bus to a faraway place, gets an apartment, and forges a new identity. After graduating high school, I worked for a time in various retail positions. I went away to college, lasted a semester before dropping out, and worked again to make some money. I boarded a bus to a faraway place, got a job and an apartment, and attempted to forge a new identity. So how I avoided this book for so long is beyond me. As I read more and more, it feels like someone wrote a book directly to me. And finally, while I mourn the fictional lives lost in the explosion, I'm glad for the act as a plot point. Yes, I did just say that I'm tired of 9/11 and terrorism fetish. However, something needed to be done to raise the stakes. An evil corporation essentially taking over the virtual world, after more or less taking over the real one, is bad news. However, as Wade said a couple of times, it's ultimately just a video game. Shit already sucks. It will just suck more. An explosion meant to kill our protagonist raises the stakes. It gives us a reason to care and an honest-to-goodness villain to root against. So yes, trite and cliche, but necessary. Without it, we can go and ignore the real world in the same way that the characters in the book have for so long. With it, we see the start of Wade's awakening as he truly begins his hero's journey. Again, hate the execution in every possible way, but I respect the hustle in getting it done. And all that brings me to the overarching theme for this episode. Last time I covered gatekeeping. The episode before, I went over the general overall negative tone since Gamergate. This time I promised to stay away from ANCAP. I also peppered in my own little riddle by telling you that you'd see what I meant by not giving away too much information. Have you figured it out yet? Yes, of course. I'm talking about spoilers. Why am I talking about spoilers? Well, regular readers of the page know that I don't believe in spoilers. I will explain why in a minute. First, I have to answer the question why I'm discussing a topic that I don't believe in. Well, I have no therapy in this episode. So instead, I'm proselytizing. I want more than that. I want to eradicate the quote-unquote no-spoiler culture from existence. Let me try to explain why. I need to start with the fact that I watched the movie about a week ago. I started by watching the D&D movie with a Twitch streamer. For some reason, I remember that Aiden enjoyed the Ready Player One movie, and I switched to that instead. It surprised me how different the movie was from the book. When I said that to Aiden, he replied, "What people always say. The books are usually different from the movie." "True," I replied, "but this one took many liberties. I talked mainly about the beginning and how there was no race in the book. One thing in the movie and the book, the explosion in the stacks. Hollywood loves themselves a good explosion. I watched the movie before reading that part in the book, and you know what? I still enjoyed the hell out of that part of the book, as I just said. I read parenthetically and I wondered, would they really be crazy enough to do it? Turns out, the answer was still yes. But even though I knew an important plot point, I could still go on as if I did not. I mean, we all knew at the end of Endgame that Thanos was going to lose, and it most likely involved Tony dying, parenthetically, spoiler alert, but we still watched and we still cheered, and we still loved that movie so much that we shit on everything that came after. Okay, looks like I have a couple themes for upcoming episodes. Back to spoilers. I used to be like you. I never wanted to know plot points. I instinctively shouted, "No spoilers!" and publicly shunned people who openly discussed them. Then I came across an argument that changed my whole viewpoint. Someone said, "If you know a spoiler and it ruins your entertainment, then perhaps it wasn't all that entertaining to begin with." Mind blown. So I tested the theory. At first, I just stopped avoiding spoilers, and if I saw them, I saw them. Then, starting with Force Awakens, I actively started seeking them out. I knew Kylo killed Han. I found out that Cap lifted Mjolnir. Actually, I guess it all started with the knowledge that Snape killed Dumbledore. In that case, I guessed and wanted verification. And you know what? In every single case, I still had a ridiculously good time reading the books or watching the movies. I mean, people proudly proclaim that they watched a movie or TV show multiple times and they still enjoy it. So, forgive me if I fail to understand or appreciate the obsession with no spoilers. I just think that there are more important ways to occupy my time and brain space by trying to avoid something that I don't consider a problem. I mean, who knows? Maybe they took the race out of sequence in the movie and it happens later in the book. Maybe they fabricated it because the first trial didn't test well with movie audiences. If it's the former, I won't sweat that I already know that Wade wins. So please, friends, fellow internet denizens, possible countrymen, lend me your ears. I come to bury the reactive no-spoiler culture and all it represents. Allow us to freely discuss our favorite books, TV shows, and movies without fear that somebody will think us vile creatures for accidentally, parenthetically, or on purpose, giving away a plot point simply because we enjoyed it so much and want to share it with people we know will enjoy it too. See the last episode about gatekeeping for some related content. If not, at least know that any discussion in this page will most likely contain what you all consider major spoilers. As always, thanks for listening. If you haven't already, you can find us at www.twoguysgaming.net. We have articles linked to our socials, including our YouTube, which I just got up and running again. I've been posting videos from the calendar, and I hope to have some other videos up there in the near future. The next episode of this will come out on Thursday. This is another busy weekend, so I think I'm only going to have two, but I did put together a schedule to be done by the time that I need to be done by. And as long as we can remain on that schedule, then I'll be all set for the next Dragonlance book in August. I will talk to you again on Thursday. See you then. Bye, guys.
We are two guys.